Hello. Welcome all. Welcome to another episode by The Angle. I have a special guest with me today. He doesn't wear a gray beard. The other guy that sits on his chair wears a gray beard, but he wears a gray hair. Scott.
How are you doing, Stanley?
Good, how's it?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good, good. So today we'll be talking around media sustainability. There is a huge case going around called the Google Antitrust. But before we get into all of that, I'll let Scott introduce himself and give us a walk through his journey, what media is and why media sustainability is important, which medias has he sustained or let down.
I'll give you a 5-minute breakdown. So without giving away my age, I started working in media, would have been the end of the 90s. I started working in SAPA, South African Press Association, which no longer exists. I started working there as a journalist and a writer. From there, I did go study at Rhodes. I did some postgraduate work in journalism. And I was always keen on digital. And that was those were the days when digital was a little bit fresh. Websites were only just starting to pop up, at least on a more official sense. I mean, it had gone a few years already.
Yeah.
So I moved to Cape Town at that time. I had a few years there. I started working at iAfrica.com. I don't know if you remember them.
The name sounds familiar.
Yeah, they're also no longer existing. They were one of the first big sort of news publishers in news at that time that had made a business of it. And from there, I poked around Cape Town for a little bit, did a little bit of media, but more specifically, I really started leaning into my journalism career and newsroom career from about 2010 or so. And that's when I started working for the Guptas, which I don't want to delve into too much, but it was I ended up leaving them quite soon.
You did say Guptas.
I did say Guptas, yeah.
Were they just capturing black people?
So this was before we knew who they were, of course. They were just, at that time, they were just computer hardware.
Well, wait. Do you still have any of their contacts?
I'm sure I do, yeah.
Hey, man, please share, man. Come on. This is the Guptas.
I'm sure we're still connected on social profiles as well.
I am following you on all socials and I'm hunting them down. Hopefully they can set foot in this country.
Yeah, I don't know if they're still active, but yeah.
Yeah. What did you do for them exactly?
So I was one of their first employees. So that mid-2010 or so, they opened the New Age newspaper, which might ring a bell.
Yeah.
I was almost literally their first employee. I helped them set up operations around the country. They had their strategy at that time was very much a regional newspaper. So they were a national paper, but they had very strong regional offices. So we moved. So I was in the car with driving around Atul Gupta, and we, Anton Gupta. Yeah, and we.
Did you call him Mr. Gupta or did you call him Anton?
I think I called him Mr. Atul. Atul. His name was Atul.
Oh, okay.
If I remember correctly, that's how they preferred to be referred to. Yeah, because there were a few brothers around, so called Mr. Gupta.
How did you meet them?
They were referred to me by a friend of mine who said they were looking guys to set up a newspaper. And I was like, well, let me go chat to them. So at that time, I didn't know who they were either.
Right.
And even at that time, I thought they were setting up a kind of like a tech hub of some sort, tech review, because they had Sahara Computers at that time. And those were the offices I met them in.
Yeah.
But very within the first meeting or so, I realized they wanted to do something much larger. And that's kind of where I really decided, I want to get stuck into this. So we moved around the country. We set up regional offices, distribution points for print. We hired some journalists. And within a couple of months, we were running. It was probably the fastest print newspaper setup that I've ever heard of. When we got back to Johannesburg, I then set up their digital arm for them.
Okay.
So it wasn't a very successful one, but nevertheless, it was a good experience. And from there, I moved. I was there for about 2 years. I left. I moved to independent newspapers for about 6 months, worked at The Star, and then I got picked up at ENCA, which is where I really started getting interested in multimedia. Of course, there was a strong broadcast arm there. In effect, the... what they started there, that was in early 2013. They were also just opening their digital arm. So okay. I also started there as kind of a startup within the bigger picture. And we set up their website. At that time as well, video was not a big thing in the local media market. Not a lot of people were doing it. But of course, as a broadcaster, that was one of the aces in their pocket. They said, we've got lots of video. So it was a really interesting and educational exercise for myself to learn how to get that video into a digital environment. So there's a few, you know, workflows there, mechanics there. It's a new kind of way of approaching journalism. And again, as I said, that's where I first started getting interested in multimedia and sort of the power of audio and video. And I like tech stuff. I like gadgets. So it kind of worked for me. I was there for a while and then went to Arena Holdings, where I headed up their multimedia division. So we set up, they didn't have podcasts at that time. We opened up a podcast studio, started doing podcasts to quite good success. That must have been end of 2017. And that's when podcasts were like, they had that. I think in the early O's, maybe 2006-07, podcasts had their first like bump. Apple Tunes got into things. This was kind of the next bump for podcasts.
At that point, were you doing video or was it only audio?
No, we started with the video was up and running already. So we were doing some news video, and I just came in there and we solidified the business case for it, which means a lot of tech backend, tech stuff and workforce.
Right. That's a lot of experience in sustainability, man.
Yeah. Left there, what year is this?
17?
I started there in 2017. I left there in 2022, mid-2022.
In the midst of the pandemic?
It was kind of over by then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we were maskless then at that point, I think.
Is it? I guess, yeah.
And I was exploring VR at that point, virtual reality. Wasn't quite money there yet, so I had to take on a job.
Is there money now?
a little more, I think. Okay. And then, in early 2023, then I took on a job at the Mail and Guardian as chief digital officer, and here we are.
Nice. All right, so what does the media landscape in South Africa look like? If you were to compare it, you've been in this for like 20 years. The first 10 years versus...
If you want
to
repeat that, yeah.
Yeah, I told you. Gonna rub it in your face. So what does it look like? How does it compare? There was a time where news was primarily newspapers and maybe radio, but we've moved to an age where it's no longer sitting just on those two channels. How does that work? How does that change come about, and what impact does it have, or did it have, in the old versus the new?
Yeah, look, I mean, depending on where you're coming from, you know, your organization you work within, your solutions in this regard will change a little bit. So, I would suggest that, and I don't really have much experience in radio or the business behind radio, so I can't speak too much to that. But I would suspect that broadcast and radio in general are still pretty stable.
Okay.
Their model is still relatively okay. My experience is a little more in print and legacy, those kind of legacy organizations. So, I'll draw some from some recent examples. For the Mail and Guardian, for example, it's kind of in a space. It's a small newspaper, small distribution. Really great brand though, has really strong journalism. But the model that they were relying on is no longer applicable.
And that model is?
They're advertising in print, essentially.
Okay, but that would be all news organizations
that's applicable to everyone. Yeah. I mean, I know Arena Holdings is having the same problems. Look at the circulation figures over the last 10 years. Everyone is literally at about a tenth what their circulation was 10 years ago. And as you know, in the last... couple months or so, Naspers did indicate they were closing down some of their other print.
They already
print publications,
did, I think. Daily Sun and the rest.
Yeah, I think they're still discussing what to do with their staff. I hope they keep them on or reintegrate. But nevertheless, that just shows. Look, they're seeing there's no point keeping this alive. They'd rather lean into the digital transformation strategies now, and take a bit of a knock.
When would you say that change happened, where print sort of dipped and digital went up?
It was a while ago already. I would say Look, everyone's been talking about digital transformation for...
For a while, yeah. I mean, everybody talks about fourth industrial revolution. I mean? These terms are just thrown around.
People have known that the print model has been... And I don't really use the word dead. I don't say it's dead because...
Is it not?
No, because even at the Mail and Guardian, it's still where the majority of the revenue is in print.
And it's a weekly newspaper. Mm. Whoa.
And so the challenge is really to... But you see it dwindling. It's not like oh, it's not dead. Okay. It's still going. It's not still going. It's going like this. Okay. But it's still kicking.
Still going. Still alive.
Still kicking. I mean, there's full teams that still service that model. The challenge that we were looking at the Mail and Guardian was, okay, how do we diversify our revenue? Mm. And taking the old way of thinking about the newspaper, how are we digitizing that? And I know previous guys who held this position, or not just in Mail and Guardian, but in previous publications, they were talking about this 10 years as well, 10 years ago. They were saying, look, we have to put an audience first. We have to figure out, you know, we have to go to where the audience is.
Yeah.
And the problems with that is the newspaper is kind of clear, right? Not even from a newspaper perspective, but from a market perspective. As an advertiser, I mean, personally, I wouldn't advertise in a print newspaper. I don't understand it. There's no metric for me to know where my $100K went for that ad.
Of course.
In the paper.
How many people pass that newspaper on? I don't get it.
It doesn't work for me. In digital, I can see exactly where my money went and what the metrics are. To change that mindset though, from the audience is there, like the scale of audience, and I'll give you an example, like. Literally, even a small newspaper for like the Mail and Guardian, the digital audience is 200 times the size of the print publication. But our revenue is...
So the trick then is how do you monetize online so that it's sustainable? Exactly. Okay. I guess in comes the antitrust issues with the Google case.
Mm-hmm.
How are media organizations sustainable outside of Google?
So,
well, I guess Google and Meta, because they both taking away from media, especially on online platforms.
So that's a really big issue. It's complicated, and I'm just going to speak in terms of my experience of it and my approach to it. I don't want to try and give like a large holistic perspective on that, because it actually changes depending on the publication, what their thing is with Google. I do want to say though that I'm pro tech. Like I'm pro big platforms. And I'll define what I mean by that.
Big platforms. what do you mean?
What I mean is you need these global platforms where everyone has to use them to some extent in order to find your audience, in order to be accessible and findable and searchable.
Well, in that line, do you draw a line rather between what would be called a monopoly or a platform that's ubiquitous?
Yeah, so that's where the difference is. My view would become, my view is not necessarily in line with other publishers,
okay,
particularly the big publishers. So this was back in March of this year. There was a series of hearings that we went out in Pretoria. The Competition Commission organized a series of hearings, which a number of publications went to go testify at. We, as the Mail and Guardian, we went to go testify at that one. But also the local publishers were there. Arena Holdings were there. News 24 was there. Even Daily Maverick was there. Everyone kind of gave their two cents in terms of what's their viewpoint. And the real question they were asking is, does Google owe us money because they've been taking our revenue?
Is that a fair question, though?
Yeah. I mean, look, this is where it starts getting complicated, because my view on the matter is you need Google. You can't really get away from Google.
Well, do you need Google or do you need a search engine?
Well, yeah, you need a search engine.
So you don't necessarily need one that's monopolizing the entire industry. If you have Bing, Firefox, Explorer, with the share of the market.
So this is the idea of monopoly for me. Like,
okay.
This, or rather the approach of product.
Right.
So if you've got the best products, the concept of monopoly will kind of follow. It's not that Google necessarily, and I'm not defending yeah. Google, I'm not talking for Google.
Sure, sure.
Just be clear on that one. but their search
yeah.
is dominant because it's the best. You can make an argument, say, in particular cavities or particular verticals right. and particular areas of search, there may be better search engines that serve a better purpose than Google.
Sure.
And that's probably true. But nevertheless, from a mass consumption perspective, Google just generally works.
But when did they get there? Were they there before they were monopoly, or did they get there before or after, essentially? Because if you look, I mean, if you follow the case, the antitrust case in the U.S., one of the rulings or one of the findings was that Google paid $20 billion oh, yeah. to Apple to have Google as the primary search engine on Apple.
No, they're a corporation. Look, their interests are to be competitive.
That behavior is just problematic, man.
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm not really going to pass judgment in terms of corporate behavior. I mean, you can right. go down a rabbit hole on that one.
Okay.
Things in general are unethical across the board. But to say, like, there's no lone actors here, lone
right.
wolves. I mean, everyone is, if you're getting paid to do something, they're paying you a huge chunk of money to put your search in part of in your browser. Yeah, okay, I'll take it.
Sure.
You know what
sure.
I mean? So,
but shouldn't that be seen as an anti-competitive behavior?
Yeah, look, you get into like economic theory here. So I've got a view on that.
Okay.
But I'm not an economist.
Okay.
But I do have a view on that in the sense of, look, if you're in a space where you're in a competitive marketplace,
right.
which is essentially a capitalist society, I wouldn't consider myself, I'm somewhat left of center if you want to push me on it, but
okay.
nevertheless, I do believe in market forces.
Okay.
There should be a competitive factor to a market.
Sure.
So the end results of a non-regulated market does become monopolies.
Right.
Like you're always going to find some big player, but through some way or some other, is going to buy their way into being the lead space, or they're
yeah.
going to have a better product, or if there's competitors that come up, they buy them out. You know, that sort of behavior does happen. So the end goal of a competitive space with that non-regulated
right.
is monopolies. It does always end up in monopolies. That would be my view. But
yeah.
this is why you get in anti-competitive behavior and you get in regulated and competition commissions
right.
and these sort of scenarios whereby they regulate that. They make
okay.
it. They make it. They make the space available for other players to be competitive.
So would you say Google, especially with all of the suite and the analytics stuff and the ad stuff, was it an add-on? Did it help media organizations, or did it throttle innovation in that space?
Yeah, look, I think you could – I mean, I would personally make the argument they're probably better analytics tools than
yeah.
than Google Analytics.
Okay.
Especially
no, but in terms of just building capacity for the organization, did Google actually help, or did it help to kill? And we're talking about this on a Google platform. This is YouTube.
No, look. Again, I mean, I think let's pinpoint the actual question here. Are publishers...
Right.
Are publishers worse off now because of Google? If any publisher wants to be a digital publisher, is Google helping them or are they hindering them? And I think it's a two-edged sword, right? I think on the whole, Google tools are very useful for publishers.
Right.
It's almost like your.
Is this like the fear of AI for writers? Is Google what it is? What is that? What Google is to publishers?
Not from my view.
Okay.
No. So I'll give you an example, right? So I would argue that, and particularly in the revenue perspective, not so much in terms of finding audience or like searchability or being found and so on. All those things Google works really well for.
Right.
But in terms of revenue, which is what the antitrust is essentially about in terms of saying, can a publisher make money using on programmatic,
right?
If the means of advertisers getting onto your platform are such that it is monopolized, and that argument is, I would probably agree with it. Google has done a pretty good job of essentially monopolizing their value chain So they're the platform providers, but they're also the advertiser providers.
Right.
And then they've got their middle ground is even you have to go through Google. And the issue for me is, okay, it works really well. That's why advertisers use it. So it makes it really easy for advertisers to get the biggest bang for their buck.
Right.
But it doesn't work for publishers because they're kind of being thrown in this pool of just with everyone else, and then advertisers, because advertisers don't care, they just want impressions. They're not necessarily at this stage, and this is kind of a different part of the conversation we can have later around the targeting particular audiences.
Right.
But like at this stage, you know, they're just looking for impressions. And Google makes it so easy for publishers not to deal with your commercial team directly to get banners or other types of advertising on your site.
But do you make more money through Google or do you make more money serving ads yourself?
Theoretically, your CPM rate direct is higher,
right?
On the most part.
How did the online media organization survive before Google? What was the sustainability model looking like back then?
Yeah, it was a little more direct then. Even in 2010, 2011. That's when it was still called, I think it was DoubleClick.
Yeah.
You remember that? And Google bought out DoubleClick. I'm not going to get the years right when they did it. But DoubleClick was a technology, a software that was there to enable getting advertisers onto platforms. And you had your own little accounts, and you could have it was just a workflow process more than anything. And your CPM rates were then quite high because the technology wasn't to the point yet where you were in a pool in like a lightning fast bidding machine pool, you know, whereby your ads are just being thrown in there. You're just saying, give me this sort of audience, this sort of sector, boom, boom, boom. You just go out and then you pay for that. Google takes a chunk of that money, gives some to the publisher. The discussion is that your audience, me as a publisher, for example, we have a particular audience. We built up that audience. We want to sell to the audience. We're interested in having a sustainable business.
Yeah.
Around our journalism, around our news outfit. Google currently, the way programmatic works and the CPM rates we get doesn't really allow that. And my argument would be that the foundations or the functionality of that technology or how it works, I don't think is that problematic for me. But the rate exchange, like the actual payments the publishers get, the percentage the publishers get of those ads and how that works, should definitely be much higher.
Okay, so it didn't help.
I guess not. It does help in terms of volume and audience and accessibility, but it doesn't necessarily help you build a business. No, definitely not.
Yeah, and what's the impact on independent media? Is it worse?
I would say if you ask me my advice, I would say if you're a small publisher, don't even bother trying to make money in programmatic.
What's your sustainability model like then?
This is what we've been building out. You would know now as well, what we're trying to build out at the Mail and Guardian would be, it's really important for publishers such as the Mail and Guardian, and even more importantly, the legacy publishers. And you've got a good head start if you've got an existing audience. Like a nice sizable audience. Yeah. You've got a good head start. You've got some good money in the bank based on your legacy publications. It's a really good opportunity for you to like rejig your back end a little bit and say, we want to be audience first and really dig down into what that means.
Right.
Plug out, surveys, really flesh out your analytics in a way that makes sense. And you have like really good segments. So you know exactly what your audience is reading, how they're reading it. And depends what your model is. If your model is just advertising, I would say as a really small publisher, and I would argue that it's not even that applicable to the Mail and Guardian at this point to really pursue an advertising model. I would pursue very much a product model in the sense
that
you're providing services to your audience. You are making it really clear who your audience is and talking to them directly.
So you have to monetize your community, essentially.
You have to build
that community, then start creating products for the community, whether it's webinars, events.
Exactly. And then whether your model is going to be subscriptions or memberships.
But can you then grow that audience without Google? We're building websites now for Google, right? When you build a website in your head, you're thinking search engine optimization. And when you're thinking search engine optimization, you actually remove the word search. You just put Google optimization, because the only search engine really that you're building for is Google. Now, it goes back to, can you survive outside of Google? What's the alternative? Can you go get funding? If it's funding, are you still an independent media? Because maybe then you have to take the biases of whoever your funder is.
I would say, if you're asking the question, can you survive? I would say yes.
How?
Can you survive to the means and the revenue that you're used to? Probably not.
So if you're
a small publisher, say for example you got a little media company, you want to do some stuff, you want to see what you can do. I'll be trying the same thing in the coming months. I could be proven completely wrong with my approach, but this is the nature of game, right? This is the nature of building businesses.
Yeah.
I'll have a website. You want that, but my model is not based on people arriving on my website.
Okay.
It's you know what I mean. It's not. It's just a place for people to go. Like if people want to know more about you, you need to have a location on the web. Otherwise, you like, if you're just on socials or you're just a newsletter, then okay. Like you need a home.
Right. Right.
But your model, just because you have a home though, doesn't mean your model needs to be based on people arriving on your website and somehow seeing an ad or somehow being onboarded via your subscription process, whatever the case is. I would suggest South Africa and probably the larger continent, you're in a tougher space economically. I mean, you look at the North American economy and there's guys there that start newsletters.
Yeah, yeah.
They get like 25,000, 30,000 subs and they're earning like a decent living. And for me, it's like, I don't know how they do that. But the economy is so different there. Like the scale of economy is so different. Here, you're going to have a tougher go of it. But I would argue the mechanics of that are the same. Like you can, if you got an audience-first approach, you found a niche. And this is another quick point. Your value as a media house, if you want to go like a general, like a broad, shallow type business, like a News 24, for example. News 24 is just volume based.
News 24 hours.
Yeah, exactly. That model, they're still struggling.
Yeah,
they're huge. I mean, they're the biggest in the country by far. But and their volumes are massive. But they're still not making any money off their operations.
Is it because they are? Their pieces are not optimized. Are they not having a wider reach?
I don't know. They had a really good presentation at the competition commission. They had a really, really interesting. They put out a really researched, well thought out slideshow as to how they're being how their business is being undermined by Google.
Right.
But it's valid for them to do that because their model is based on volume.
Okay. Was that the common theme within the presentations made at the Competition Commission around how Google undervalues business, or were there other concerns?
No, that was the main concern. It was mainly the revenue, the ad ops side of things.
Yeah. So is it that Google's not sharing enough?
That would be my perspective.
I would say
the percentage that we receive from as a publisher from Google should be higher.
Okay.
If you're in the volume game.
Okay.
And this is kind of the difference you need to make when you're thinking about media. Like you need to be a little more specific. Your model will be particular to your publication. Like Mail and Guardian, for example, should not be in the volume game at all. They can very much be in a very like narrow, deep model, in the sense that they're providing value to subscribers. Even if they're in a space where they're getting 15,000 odd subscribers every month, they're in a healthy space because they're providing a particular product there and no one else is doing it. And that's valid for the Mail and Guardian. So in that perspective, they don't need Google from a programmatic perspective, from an ad ops perspective, but they do need a website. They need to be found and searched. But their model is based more on like direct audience.
Can businesses, you've answered a lot around how media organizations can be sustainable outside of Google. What other techniques do you feel newsrooms should adopt in this current climate to be more competitive, to serve their news much better with the birth of social media? I see a lot of news organizations are forcing newspapers on people who want to consume TikTok. How do news organizations maneuver around what the current picture looks like, essentially?
So again, I probably have a slightly differing view on, I mean, just taking social media, for example.
Right.
There's no question as to that's where the audience is. That's where people consume stuff. Even myself, with my gray hair, I still consume social media. That's kind of where I wouldn't say that's my source of news.
Right.
But it does give me my ins to news. Right.
Okay. Like
that's where I'm seeing the first sort of great headlines.
Why isn't a source of news?
My source of news.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on your. So brand still matters, right? So
okay.
I mean, if I'm my particular feed is maybe a little more, quote unquote, official. So there's New York Times and Washington Post,
yeah.
And, you know, this kind of.
So it can be a source of news.
Yeah, it is a source of news. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm also kind of a stickler on push notifications. I like getting push notifications on my phone, so I can just see the headlines, and you know, that's enough for me. But that's not quite social media. My issue with social media is that's where the audience is. That's where you have to be.
Yeah.
But to make money there it's not really viable. So up until a few years ago, although a lot of news organizations still feel this way, is that if we're going to put effort into social media, and it does take effort, if you want to do it well,
it does resources take effort. And stuff,
If you want to do like quick interviews with your journals, you want to do some video, you want to do some audio, you want to have some like cool graphics there, that's all the stuff you need to feed the beast of social
media. Wouldn't you say it's easier to monetize your community on social media than it would the traffic on your website?
Yes. But how you do that is hard. But theoretically, you're quite right. So I would say my view of social media was the intention of it and putting the effort of it was never to say, you're asking the question, what's the metric for success there? And the metric for success there was not links back to the website.
Yeah.
And if that's your metric for success these days in social media, and there's quite a lot of research in the last year or so that's showing the referral traffic from social media is dropping quite a lot for publishers.
Mm.
And there's probably a few different reasons for that. One, because social media is really good at keeping you on their platform.
Right.
But also publishers are not pushing the link back as much. They're just saying, you're there, here's our stuff.
Right.
This is what we're working on. Consume it here, we're happy.
Should news organizations be looking at social media for that? Shouldn't you just go, here are social media platforms, let's build a community. We've got 5 million followers across all platforms. How do we monetize this?
Yeah.
Let that be a different revenue stream than trying to drive traffic from here to, I mean, look at TikTok. TikTok is big. You can put a link in there for people to click away. That now, when you have 5 million subscribers or followers on TikTok, what do you do? Can you not monetize that? Can you not sell events to those? And the ways that newsrooms can monetize social media outside the link backs to their website, because
just
send them to the website if that's what you want to do.
So again, I mean, you have to, if we're talking about news organizations, right? We're not talking about influencers and individuals and so forth. They have a different tool set available to them. They can throw themselves into affiliate advertising and you know, push products and things in their videos. News organizations can't really do that. It's just frowned upon. It's not really part of their model. You could probably find examples of those that do, but it's not common practice. Okay. So you're quite right. Events, if you're looking at revenue diversification, events is a big one. Good examples of the Mail and Guardian is we have those big flagships like 200 Young South Africans,
Power of Women,
which is coming up next week. We've got Greening the Future, which is the end of November. So these are relatively large-ish events. 200 Young South Africans are by far the biggest, and that's been going. I think next year is actually the 20th year going. So those are money making events for us, but they also only they're kind of valid because they're attached to the Mail and Guardian brand.
Yeah.
So if you're on social media, for example, yes, you can sell them events. There are some models that we have played with, like sponsored content, which we can certainly sell, quote unquote, our size of our audience on social media platforms. So it's part of the cost to the sponsor.
Yeah.
And say, look, you know, you're gonna give us an article or video, whatever the case may be. And, you know, along with that audience that's on our website, we can also have, you know, we have 1 million odd followers on Twitter,
right.
500,000 in Facebook and so on and so forth. And that's part of that cost, and your product will be, or your piece of content that you give us will be on those platforms. And that's part of the monetization. That doesn't work so well for small, tiny publishers, though. That works okay for larger legacy publishers.
So how do you build a small one? I mean, shouldn't you build on socials first? Build that audience there, and then create a demand on socials, then start building podcasts and news.
Socials are essential.
Right.
Absolutely, 100% essential. But in the context of making money,
They're not resource intensive, right?
Shouldn't they be the best place to start
instead of starting with things that are very resource intensive, like absolutely. A newsroom, like building an entire newsroom for a small organization, which is going to require a lot of resources.
But if you're
resources.
In the space of building a brand, right?
Yeah.
Like, take The Angle, for example.
Sure.
If you're in the space, you've just started it up, you've got a website, you've got some social media presence, that your time frame for doing that within this particular content that you're working with,
yeah.
it's quite long. Right. So there's a space there. There's things, you know, we could all talk about, say, how do we speed this up? How do we do it? And there's work involved in that. There's strategies that we can pursue around that. But revenue immediately is.
Yeah, it's not immediately available to you. You have to pivot a bit. There's a lot you got to do until you are sustainable and you make a bit of money. But the question, I guess, my concerns are around how do you set up safely in this day and age? Because I still see a lot of small media organizations going the bigger media organizations route. They look at those guys and they go, this is how you made it. This is how you came up. If I can take that and implement in my organization, maybe I'll make it. But they don't have the same resources.
Yeah.
They're not even as well funded as those ones were when they started. Now, hence I'm asking, how do you start how the bigger ones started? Or what's the better way to start?
I think, you know, the better way to start is being as small as possible, small and slim as possible.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, you want to be as specific as to your intent as you can. So
right.
be as specific as to what product you're trying to push out there. And, you know, we're in media, so our product at the end is actually a content product. But
yeah.
the products as to how you get into your audience, how you're serving that quote-unquote product
right.
to your audience is kind of where your revenue and your growth ends and where your audience sits. I would say start small. You can be consistent. You can be daily,
right.
but you be very particular with your approach to your audience. Otherwise, in the absence of money, that's the only way to do it. Otherwise, you're going to burn yourself out. And you're going to do substandard content, which effectively, I mean, you can talk product all you want, and I'm essentially a product guy, in the sense that I care about the tools that gets the content to the audience,
right.
And in turn of that, it's a circular motion that since the tools do indicate the content to some extent and so forth, the analytics, for example, will inform the content and so on. But you've got to be tight. Otherwise, because right. I mean, look at all the big legacy publishers. Those guys they didn't like start small. They came in with a huge lump of cash and built out a newsroom from scratch. There's a huge amount of money, and then they can be in a competitive space like that. But you need, like, it's not even a viable conversation to talk about that happening. So it's just like, okay, where do we start? If there's like two or three of us and we're like, we're really keen on starting something up, I mean, you know, well, I mean, with The Angle for yourself, I mean, how are you thinking about your trajectory? I mean, you've got other stuff on the go. You've got people making, you need to make money doing other things. You want The Angle to be something. There's resources that you put into in time.
Yeah.
How do you want to approach it? You know?
Let's leave The Angle for now. You want to put me out like that. Sorry to go back to the antitrust thing, right? I wanted to ask around the... How do you think it's just a solution enough to build other search engines or to share more
I think the intention, as I understand it, would be Google to share more. And
isn't that not perpetuating the problem? I mean, Google still has all this data on organizations. They're still monopoly into the market. Is it still helping organizations at that point?
So again, I would argue that, you know, when we started, my initial point was, you know, I'm pro-tech in the sense that I'm in a tech space. Essentially, yeah. I'm in a media content space, but I'm effectively in a tech space. So I want to use the internet. I want to use the digital space and the various tools that we have available to us in order to build the best products I can on what we're doing. So I do want to use the likes of Google. I think to speak in terms of, if you're looking at the big players, right?
Yeah.
It's not really applicable to the size of myself or the angle or something like that. Whether we're using Google or not, I don't think we're in that space.
No. So at what point do you get there?
So again, I don't know. What's the tipping point? I don't know. It's kind of like a space where if you're in a volume model.
So it's a volume-based thing.
If you're in a volume-based thing and you've got a sizable operation.
Okay.
I think you have room to say, look, our product is reaching millions of people, but we don't have a viable business. I think it's a fair concern to say that and say, you know, our business has been running for such amount of time. We have a huge newsroom. We're doing a public service, but we just can't make a viable business. And that's kind of where a lot of the disgruntlement is coming from Google. My point is with Google is like, you can make monopolistic claims. You can discuss the ethics of it, or, you know, the evils of capitalism, whatever you want to get into. The point is, it is what it is. And I don't think by calling out Google and saying, what discussion can we have about percentages and rates?
Yeah.
I don't think this is an unfair discussion. The problem I have is you look at the Canadian solution, for example, that when in the same case that we're dealing with in South Africa. I'm not going to remember all the details of it now, but you can check it out. Essentially, there was a payout.
Okay.
But what happened in an offset of that, Google says, okay, well, you know, bugger you. Yeah, we'll pay you out. But now all our programs, like the Google News initiatives and all those millions that get pumped into those programs, which South Africa still has, we'll just use that money to pay you out and then we'll say bye. So there's no more of those programs. So it's like, you got to, the larger perspective of Google and the ecosystem they provide, in my view, and not everyone agrees with me. In fact, this probably won't do me any good in getting a new job or something. But,
oh boy.
But like, you don't. It doesn't offset the loss of programmatic revenue. Like, the ecosystem, in my view, is more valuable than just that programmatic revenue. If you're a news organization, there's a lot more that you can use Google for to ensure the success of your business than just saying, oh, well, we're not earning enough from our advertising.
There's do you know how to set it up?
What do you mean?
How do you set up Google so that it delivers more value to your business?
Well, I think it's what's your...
If you were to advise someone who's starting a small news organization, they're at a point where they've got the right numbers and they can monetize using Google. How would they set it up?
Look, I mean, the tools that Google has available to you and the programs, I think are far more, and they're mostly free, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder why.
Yeah, again, I mean...
You know, if something is free, you are the product.
Yeah, exactly. But, look, no, absolutely, there's a conversation behind that. But again, I mean, what's your intent? If your intent is... If you want to start a media company, right, and just want to service a particular audience, you want to find your niche, and you want to make a little bit of a business out of it, I would argue that you probably don't have much of an option to not use Google in some way, depending on your approach, right? Depending on what you want, but you could find other tools out there. There are other software suites and that don't use Google directly, but the internet does use Google. The internet is Google.
They monopolize the internet. That's
for the
Google
most part,
for you.
Yeah. I mean, to argue...
I mean, for now you use the word Google it instead of look it up online.
I mean, to argue to say it shouldn't be like that, for me, it's not even really a worthwhile conversation. It's we're where we are. And I don't think it's all evil. I think it's more like you use it to your own advantage as well. And allows the space for competitors to
come in.
To come in. And that's where you get the best product, because or the best tools for what you want to build. I don't know. My view is it isn't necessarily in line with a lot of the other publishers out there.
Is there still funding for media organizations in South Africa? Yep. Is it easier to start a media organization and get it funded?
So interesting that you asked. I had a chat with Google earlier this week. I went to the offices.
Please don't tell me they fund media organizations.
They do fund media organizations.
So they can serve ads through.
They fund ecosystems. So they're not interested in funding startups or small media organizations. Okay. Startups are not really interested in that, but they are interested in. And I'm not punting Google. I'm not a Google representative in any way. They're interested in funding tools that will enable a new ecosystem. So, for example, like, we've got some ideas. Say you and I had started up a business and we're saying we're interested in increasing AI usage in newsrooms, for example.
Right.
And we would go on a kind of like a training program of some sort. We'd set up the tools. You know, we would distribute that sort of information to the ecosystem. Right. We would do that with Google funding. They would pay us to go do that kind of stuff.
Would we have to use their AI tools? What is it, Gemini?
I don't know, actually. I don't know what the restrictions are.
There you go. They're training their models on your data.
Probably. But, I remember having this conversation. It must have been, I think, when Google Drive was first kind of came out. I don't know what year it was.
Yeah.
Well, I started thinking about it in 2013 or so, and I was like, my first impression was I don't want to use Google Drive.
Okay.
This is where, because I don't want Google reading my stuff, because of course they're going to read your stuff.
Of course.
Don't use Google Drive for photo storage. So I used to do, like, I've got quite a lot, big backlog of footage and content over the years, and I need a cloud server to host it. So I used to use Amazon. Then Amazon made a very strange decision a year and a half or so.
How do you know that Amazon's not reading that stuff either?
I don't know. Whatever. But they don't have the same sort of context as Google, right?
Okay.
So I just had all my stuff there, and then they made a strange decision. It's only photos and videos, so all my other stuff that came with my projects, like text and documents and projects and so forth, I couldn't have them there, so it became irrelevant to me. So I've been looking for a new platform. Mm-hmm. And Google Drive is affordable. It's kind of like it's scalable in terms of cloud.
Right.
But I don't want to put my stuff there, because there's too many stories of Google just deciding, it doesn't like what you're doing there, so it blocks your account. For me, that's not in spirit of me as a subscriber. Like, they don't need to care about me as an
subscriber. Right. But at least respect the data that I host with you.
They could end my life by just deleting all my stuff and move on with theirs.
Right.
They actually could. Yeah. So in that sense, no, I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking on AI tools, do you recommend them for the newsroom?
In some ways, yes. So
are they not threats to journalism, writers?
So we did some experiments last year. We did actually explore some stuff.
At MNG?
Yeah. We did explore some stuff. In fact, we were part of a program, Financial Times, up in London. We were on a program with them for a few months. It was more a subscription-based program, but we wanted to use... We were still in a space where we wanted to increase the traffic to the website, and we still wanted to really build out a subscription business.
Yeah.
Part of the tools we looked at to do that was, using AI for headlines, SEO, tagging of the
problems,
tagging of the stories, and so on. And as soon as we did mention in the newsroom, there was some kickback. Everyone got nervous, right? Which I understand, absolutely.
Okay.
Particularly in the subs, the sub-editors. But the trick is you can use AI. To use AI to generate content is a very, very different conversation to have than using AI to optimize what you're doing. So if you're optimizing your distribution, optimizing, finding the right audience for it, or like... taking a multimodal approach to your story, like Mail and Guardian stories, for example, are very more of a long form, deeper journalism. That model itself, like here's a bunch of text and like maybe an image from doesn't work so well on the internet. You want to do more with that. So you want more access points into that story.
Yeah.
So you can use AI to say, okay, here's a story. The journalism is intact. Like the journalism is done. It's all the checked and balances. It's published.
Right.
You can use AI to like repurpose that content in a much easier and better way than than using more humans. Yeah. So you can use it, you can create, like, you know, translations being one of them. You can do what's the best tweets, LinkedIn posts, Facebook posts, whatever, to kick back on this content. You can create videos from that content. Okay. You can take that content and put it into, make a audio file out of it. There's all different ways you can use AI to do that. And there's lots of other tools.
Would you recommend tools like Grammarly for the writers?
Grammarly? I haven't used Grammarly.
It's basically an AI tool that does syntax for you.
That's a tough one, because then you're messing with people's jobs, right? So if the sub-editor, and it depends how good your sub-editor is,
but right.
If the sub-editor is not good, I would support Grammarly. If the sub-editor is good, I'd be like, okay, there's other value they can bring to the table.
There's no other value that Grammarly would give a writer outside subbing?
I don't know. I haven't used it, so I'm not so familiar with it.
No. Okay, maybe not Grammarly, but any other writing tool that... When you write, I mean, you're writing. This thing's not writing for you. All it's doing is just helping you with
I use some AI tools. I don't use it to generate content for me directly, but I do say, for example, if I need starting points for ideas, for example, that's very useful in that case. I do use it sometimes to, like, you know, generate me like a selection of tweets or whatever the case may be.
Okay.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any problem with that.
Okay.
I do have a... If you're a writer and that's your job to be as a writer, you would have to be. I think you'd have to have disclaimer of some kind.
Should you? Whoa. I mean,
if you say
I was assisted by Grammarly, writing community would come for your ass.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's kind of like to say, oh, we used AI a little bit in this story. It's kind of like the same thing as saying, oh, we used the internet a little bit in the story. It's like, obviously you did.
Right. So. What AI tools would you recommend for a small media organization? Just to say, capacity building, you're starting up, here are tools you can look out for, and these are the users of the tools.
Yeah, I couldn't rattle off a bunch of names, but I've only really just started exploring other tools, for example, for presentations, slide generation, things like that, for like helping assist the presentation of ideas, that kind of thing. That helps out a lot.
So nothing really in the newsroom?
Nah. You're putting this on in terms of naming stuff, which I couldn't do.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, are there tools that you'd recommend for the newsroom that can be used without naming them?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
100%. Would you recommend that the newsroom have some AI tools?
100%.
There wouldn't be backlash
I think newsrooms should embrace AI. It's like saying, you know, 20 years ago, should the newsroom embrace the internet? Hell yeah.
Okay, so AI is like a website instead of...
No, AI is like it's like an ecosystem of stuff to make your job easier. So
I'm saying in how they should look at it is, you once existed in print. The internet came, you existed online. You did not cheat print. You just migrated to online.
Look,
now you're writing and you're doing all of this heavy lifting, and there are AI tools. This is the next step of the internet.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think this conversation has been going on for like 25 years, right? It's like we're still in the on the waves of the internet disruption, and AI is just the latest iteration of that wave. Where it's going to end up for us, we're going to have similar problems. It's going to have, like, you've got all these issues of, should AI be blocked from reading our website and using it in their responses? There's all kinds of those kind of conversations going on. My view is, like, which AI are you going to stop? I mean, you stop one company is one AI,
right?
You know, legally, then, you know, there's another one. You know, it doesn't really hold water for me.
Yeah.
It's kind of like saying, you know, you're not going to publish your stuff online. I mean, you can make that decision. Have just a zine. If you find a model to make that work for you, go for it.
But would regulation for newsrooms help around AI? Should media organizations sit together and go, okay, here are AI tools that are acceptable in the newsroom, and you create some sort of consent and
community and buy-in on that? There is a bit of effort in that space.
Okay.
There is some effort in that space. In fact, I wrote together some sort of policy for MNG around AI.
All right, AI.
We didn't publish it on site, but there's like a working document there. I know lots of other news organizations have done the same. I would suspect that there would, I stand to be corrected, but there has been some mutual conversations okay. around what should the, how should the industry be approaching this. Because South Africa's market is small, in the States they kind of do it by organization. But in South Africa, you're in a space where you know, you can have a, you can have like a joint front, kind of like the same way they're approaching the Google Google antitrust.
Okay, okay. So you, you do recommend AI tools for news, for news organizations, guys?
Absolutely.
If you're running a media organization, you heard it from Scott. Get AI tools. You didn't hear it from him. You heard it from him.
I stand by it.
Yeah, I think it's about time to wrap it up.
Okay, cool.
Any parting shots around sustainability? We know a news, a media organization can have AI tools. We know a media organization cannot really exist outside of Google because that's where most of the revenue comes from. There is funding, but there are biases there. Are we leaving anything else that can, oh, there's social media, please use social media, build a community and monitor the community on social media. There's about four there. Is there anything else that can assist in sustainability that we left out?
Look, it's a hard gig, hey? It's very hard to make, to build a media business, even the legacy ones, to find sustainability, to find a path forward. Everyone's struggling, not just South Africa, not just Africa. You know, all the big hitters are seeing a huge drop in their revenue. Their models that they're used to are dissolving in some way, in terms of just in terms of referral traffic and how that used to work. Look, it's a hard gig, man. I wouldn't put myself in the spot and say, oh, this is the way to have a sustainable business. I think it's going to tie in very closely to what you actually want to do, where's your space.
Yeah.
But something that is very consistent among all of them is they're approaching very much an audience-first perspective on what they're doing. They didn't have as much pressure previously to do that because the machine was kind of working, right? Now the machine's not working as well, so they're like, okay, well, who are our readers? How do we deal with them? How do we keep them? What do we want to give them? And this is where, like, this is why there's such a rise of the product division. So the product division... I mean, it's always been there in one form or another, but it's only now that it's particularly in newsrooms, like the product person or the product division is becoming so much more important.
Right.
A little more important than the editor and the commercial person, because the one, they join the two of those.
Yeah.
But it, they're also thinking about how do we get what the journalists are doing to how where do it's supposed product, to be, and how do we monetize, and that's becoming increasingly an important role. Okay. So. Yeah, that would be
The fifth one, productize. Build a product development team in your media company and make sure you productize a lot of things to for your sustainability. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been the Angle Podcast with Scott.
Mm.
Thanks you for tuning listening. In, man. Thanks Until for next time.
Cheers.